Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host. And once again, thank you so much for tuning in today. Today, we've got Jake Eagle joining us. He is actually a licensed psychotherapist for 25 years, and now he coaches and mentors individuals and couples. He and his wife have created books, online courses, retreats, programs. You can check them out at liveconscious.com, L-I-V-E, conscious.com. And there you're going to find unbelievable amounts of resources, blog posts, like I mentioned, retreat opportunities, and several courses, one of which I actually took, and we talk about extensively in this interview. Jake and Hannah bring about this very different view of relationships in their course, Dating, Relating, and Mating. And they bring up this idea that it should be easy. You don't have to push into your wounds to heal through your partner, that you actually should think about your values. I mean, what an idea, right? Before you get married, spend time thinking about what your core values are, how they relate to the other person, if you're in fact compatible. They set up a very simple program that helps you walk through these things in a way that just makes it feel like it's really doable. I enjoyed the course. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I know you will too. If you want more information, again, check out liveconscious.com, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thanks a lot for listening. Welcome to this week's episode of The Art of Authenticity. I'm Laura Coe, your host, and thank you once again for joining us. Today we have Jake Eagle joining us all the way from Hawaii. How are you, Jake?
I'm good. Aloha. Nice to be with you.
I'm just desperately trying not to lose myself in jealousy over this Hawaii location. Well,
I won't describe what it's like here this morning.
All right, go ahead, please tell us. Is every day perfect?
Every day is pretty stunning. Yeah, 78 degrees, nice cool breeze, intermittent rain throughout the day. Beaches are only 10 minutes away. It's pretty spectacular.
I mean, I haven't made my way to Hawaii yet. This is on my short list of places I really want to go. But everybody who goes loves it. Which island are you on?
We're on the Big Island, and we just moved here. We only have been here for 6 months, so it's all very fresh and new to us.
What is the biggest thing that you've adjusted to leaving the mainland?
Oh, lots of adjustments. The biggest challenge has been that we had a community on the mainland. I'd been in Santa Fe for 25 years, and Hannah, my wife, had been there for 50 years. So we just had a tremendous community, and we got here and had no community. And that was a huge adjustment. And we're still in the process of adjusting.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I think the reason I'm asking is because so many people think, oh my God, you're in Hawaii, everything must be perfect. But you know what? The setting around you doesn't make things necessarily easy. It can be very difficult to make such a big change.
Yeah, I learned this, I think it was 23 or 4 years ago. We were on our honeymoon and in Greece. We got married in Greece on an island. Mm. And I had this insight that no matter where I go, I take myself.
There you go, right?
Yeah. You know, I thought everything would be idyllic and romantic and perfect. And there I was, and still dealing with anxiety and concerns. And yeah.
It's that great book, Wherever You Go, There You Are. It's the title is just, when you really think about that, that's just a really powerful idea. You can change it all up, change everybody around you, but if you don't deal with the things going on within you. And that brings me to the first topic that I really want to jump into. And I just, you guys are in for a treat today. We're with somebody who is just a warehouse of incredibly high value information. I'm just trying to get as much as I can out of you, Jake. But in all seriousness, you have a program, Dating, Mating, and Relating, which I have recently signed up for and making my way through. And it's very, very interesting. It's a course on relationships, you guys, if you want to check it out. The links will be on our site. But the thing that struck me right away, we talked about for a second before we hopped on, was that so much of what you're talking about is common sense. There's some things that are counterintuitive, which were really cool and I want to talk about. But this, I wanted to first speak to you about this idea that when we get started in a relationship, when we go out and date, right, people are meeting in bars and they talk about putting their best foot forward. They put on like the nicest clothes they have and they get dressed and, you know, they try to have the best conversation that they can. And from there, right, you kind of, you get a little infatuated with people and the image of them and the concept of them. And you're also kind of hiding yourself on some level. And you really jump into a lot of this and talk about how dangerous that can be to not be yourself. And this show is really about authenticity and being yourself. But I didn't really think about it in this context. Can you talk to the audience a little bit about this first phase of dating and the difficulty of what that leads to later in the relationship if you, you know, were to meet somebody and just try to put your best foot forward? What's really wrong with that?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. But before I do, I want to go back to the way you introduced this, which is very revealing. So you said the program called Dating, Mating, Relating. And actually, it's not, but that's what most people think. It's Dating, Relating, Mating.
I'm sorry.
So, no, don't be. It's actually very helpful. So it's actually what most people do. They date, and then we use mating basically to suggest long-term commitment and sexual involvement, right? So most people go from dating to thinking that they're having a long-term relationship, or they very quickly get sexually involved with their partner. And so they're mating.
Yeah.
But they haven't done the relating. And that's one of the things that's unique about our approach is we're saying you go through a period of dating. I'll give you a short overview. You go through a period of dating. It's typically going to be probably 1 or 2 months, maybe 3 months at the most. And then you have enough information to say, does this look good? Are we feeling positive about each other? Is our chemistry compatible, which is one of the most important things we find out when we're dating. And our view on this is that dating should really be easy. It should be light. It should be fun. It should not be work. It is not a time to negotiate about our differences. It is not a time to work on relating. That comes later. And if we approach dating in this way, the idea is that it's very easy and natural. And if it's not easy and natural, we suggest that you stop. And at that point, particularly if you haven't gotten infatuated, it's pretty easy to stop because you don't have much of an investment. Then you enter into the relating phase, which is where you do all of those other things, like you negotiate about your differences, you discuss your boundaries, you talk about the fact that you have different styles and different values, and what are we going to do about that? You talk about your dreams and where you want to go in your life. And that's a process that can take, let's say, 6 months to a year, year and a half. And our belief is that after doing that for a year, a year and a half, you also have enough information to decide, do I want to make a lifelong commitment to be with this person? And if I don't have clarity that I want to make a lifelong commitment after a year and a half or a year, again, it's probably the wrong match. I probably should let go and move on, which is harder to do than back in the dating stage. But I often work with people who come to me, they've been in relationship for 4 or 5 years, they haven't made a long-term commitment, and it's as if they're still waiting to learn something, and there's not a lot new that you're going to learn after 4 or 5 years of being with someone.
Yeah.
And so this is why we make this distinction. There's this dating stage, it's relatively brief, very light, very easy, mostly about fun. Then there's the relating stage, maybe lasts a year. That's where we do, if you want to use the expression, the work. My wife, Hannah, and I don't really believe that relationships take hard work. And we think that that's one of the misconceptions. And if you work hard at it and it goes well, what you've done is you've created a foundation where you'll have to continue to work hard.
Mm.
And we don't want to do that. We want it to be relatively easy. Hannah said to me years ago, she said, love can be easy. And at the time, I didn't really know what she meant. I didn't grok that, but over the last 15 years, I've come to agree with her completely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to back up because you said something I think is so important. This first phase, it's easy and fun, but I mean, there's a lot of people out there who are in the dating world and they've got a lot of pushbacks, right? Which I'm sure you've heard them all, but I'm introverted. It's not easy for me. I don't know how to strike up conversations. I'm uncomfortable till people get to know me, or like, right? All these kinds of things that we say to ourselves to debunk this idea that there should be some level of ease to the whole thing. What do you say to those kind of replies?
Well, this gets to the idea behind your podcast and authenticity. And you see, I think that whoever I am, however I present myself, I actually feel that I'm being authentic. So if I'm introverted and scared, or I'm shy, or I'm reserved, I actually think that that is authentically where I'm at this time in my life. And I encourage people to not hide, to reveal whoever it is that you are. If you're shy or you're introverted, start off there and say to people, you know, I'm kind of shy, I'm introverted, I'm not particularly good at striking up conversations, but I'd like to get to know you better. Don't pretend to be something other than what you are. Sometimes when people talk about authenticity, my experience is that they're talking about their best self, right?
Right.
And people will say, I have an example in my book of a couple who came in for counseling, and the man was treating his wife very poorly, and she got upset with him, and he said something really offensive to her, and he knew it, and he stopped, and he said, I'm sorry. He said, that's not my authentic self. That's not really who I am. And I said to him, sure, that's who you are. Otherwise, you wouldn't have said it. Don't pretend that you're somebody other than who you are. I said, that is part of you. So what I'd like you to do is not deny it, but talk about what's behind that. Where do those feelings come from? What's going on? Why do you give yourself permission to talk to your partner in this way? To me, that's a really powerful conversation.
Yep. And I think that's right. This Instagram, this is my authentic self, best foot forward, right? Like looking like great, my new pair of glasses or whatever it is people are doing. That doesn't mean you're being authentic. Authentic is whatever's really happening in the moment. That's your truth. That's how I interpret that.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I haven't heard people use that description. I've heard people with what I think of as sort of a biased idea of authenticity.
Yeah, that's what has driven me to make this podcast, is sort of debunking this concept of, you know, if I just twofold, one is if I just find my authentic self, everything else will just work. Yeah, if you take action in the world, you can't just sit and, you know, hang out in your apartment. You have to actually be in the world. And then two, that, right, I a lot of life is difficult, and sometimes you have bad feelings, and that's okay too, right? There's nothing wrong with having a sad day, or like, I hate this idea of any feeling being right or wrong.
Yes, right. And the only distinction I would make is your comment that life is or can be difficult. I would say sometimes I make life difficult. I don't think life in and of itself is anything. I think it's an experience, it's an array of stimulation. And then I interpret all of that, make meaning of it, and the way I make meaning determines my experience. I can make meaning in a way where I say, this is hard, this is difficult, or I can make meaning in a way where my experience is that life isn't difficult. It is an opportunity for growth and evolution and change and deeper connection with myself and other people.
Absolutely. I guess I think that there is a line maybe where there's a real external factor, dear friends of the family, the husband drowned in a lake one day, right? It's just, it's very traumatic for the whole family. And, you know, it's just, you go through those phases and you bring forward your truth in those moments too, that this is just a very hard time, but it doesn't have to be pathologized, is what I guess I meant.
Yeah. And again, I like the distinction you're making, because you're drawing a line about, say, a tragedy or a trauma. But what I see people doing is talking about being traumatized because the waiter didn't speak to them well.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Being traumatized, yeah, because some really minor thing. So I agree with you that there are events that happen in life. I think that what I remind people is that they're rare for the most part. Most of us live incredibly fortunate lives. Most of the people listening to this podcast are very safe. You know, I mean, things happen once in a while to adults where we can be a victim. But for the most part, I think it's incredibly unusual. And what I think happens instead is that we victimize ourselves when we're really not victims.
Absolutely. And this is the narratives, you know, that we tell ourselves, and then they disempower us and we have a real hard time with change, which really brings me to this first part that I know you've said a lot of times, and it's so jarring. I think the listeners would love to hear about it. But one of your first points in this relationship course is this idea of being intolerant at the beginning, which I've never heard anybody say. How did you guys come up with this idea of being intolerant? Could you talk to the audience a little bit about, I think, quite unusual view of relationships?
Yes. I really learned this primarily from my wife, from Hannah. Essentially, she holds a very high expectation of me and always has. And if I go back 23 years when we first started to be together as a couple, at the time, I was quite flirtatious with other women. And she strongly objected. And essentially, it was an argument. She basically would say, I don't like it when you flirt and give attention to other women. And I would say, hey, I'm actually a trustworthy guy, and this is not a problem. And I really was trustworthy. In other words, I didn't do anything other than give women superficial attention. I didn't ever get involved with anyone else. Mm-hmm. But what I was missing was what it was like for Hannah to see me do that. She made herself terribly uncomfortable, extremely anxious, and I didn't really think about that. I was, at the time, I think I was pretty immature. I was lost in my own perspective, and I was doing what I wanted to do, getting attention in ways that I'd always gotten attention. So she was intolerant of this and basically said, she wasn't telling me what to do, but she was saying, mm-hmm. If you want to be with me, this doesn't work for me because I can't be relaxed with a man who is flirtatious. And that's an example of being intolerant, saying this won't work. You have to decide which is more important to you. Do you want to be with me or do you want to flirt with other women? That's up to you. I'm not going to tell you what's right or wrong. I'm just going to tell you what works for me and what doesn't work for me. And then you have to make a decision. So it was a huge decision because it's a way that I had behaved for a long time. And when I heard the impact of my behavior on her, I fairly quickly, after a few months of arguing about it, I fairly quickly realized what was important to me was being with her, and I needed to grow up and change my behavior.
Is the key the point that you made that so being intolerant, but then the way you expressed it, I just want to draw some attention to that she was very clear with this is what works for me and what doesn't work for me, and then you have to make up your own mind. Is that the key to this kind of communication so that it doesn't become this endless, you know, circular dynamic of argument?
Exactly. I think there's two or three keys. One of the things that we teach in our work is called perception language. And what that is, it's a way of communicating where I'm always talking about my experience, my perception of the world, my perception of you. I'm never telling you or another person about them. So it makes it much easier for the other person to hear me. Another aspect of our work is something called witnessing. So when Hannah and I have a disagreement, the one who is the most upset will share whatever's going on for that person by talking about their experience, what they are doing to themselves, not what the other person is doing. Hannah didn't say, you make me anxious
right. When
I was flirting. She said, I make myself anxious. I discomfort myself. This is just who I am. It's not something I want to change about me. I'm not trying to become comfortable being with a man who's flirtatious. I just want you to know this is who I am. You have to decide if that works for you or not. So that allowed me to really hear what she was saying. And the point I was making is that we do something called witnessing. So all I'm doing is listening to her. I'm not rebutting. I'm not explaining my point of view. I'm just trying to understand what it's like for her in that situation. If I want to share my experience, I do that in a separate conversation later.
Interesting. So even after you've listened, so at the end, you just say, thank you for sharing that. And then you come back at another time.
Yeah, two things happen at the end. I either really get it. It's like, I immediately understand what she is describing as her experience. And I may just join with her and say, my gosh, I had no idea this was so hard for you. I don't want to be contributing to you feeling that way. And so I'm going to absolutely stop that behavior. Sometimes we just join together and keep going. Other times it's information. I may not see it the same way. I may not disagree. Feelings may come up, in which case I just need to sit with myself, get clear, which I believe is my responsibility to be clear before I go back and talk to her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And here's a question. So in that case, she was clear with her boundaries. You understood and it changed. But what happens when both people, I mean, when you get to an impasse where both people just don't feel that they want to change? I mean, you don't want to break up the relationship necessarily, but everybody is also entitled to hold their views and their boundaries.
Yes, and this is where one of the other things we do in the relating stage is we form agreements, what we call high-level agreements. So what are the four or five things they're kind of non-negotiable for you? If we're in relationship, what are the four or five things that I should know, and I should know that these are not things you are inclined to change or even want to negotiate?
Mm-hmm.
If you and I have a conflict around those really high-level agreements that we each have, we probably are going to have problems, and we should really consider if it makes sense to continue. If we have agreement around those four or five top values, then the things where we disagree are at a lower level, and probably one or both of us will be willing to compromise most of the time. And we'll just, either one of us will compromise and we'll live with the differences we have, or there may be certain things that we agree, we're not going to agree, but it's okay.
Yep. Makes perfect sense. And these are the things, and this is, I hope you guys are out there listening, and I'm telling you, I'm doing this course. I think you should check it out. It's very cool, whether you've been, if you're single, if you're with somebody for a few years, if you've been in a relationship for decades, it's really for anybody. But I just don't think most of us have taken the time, or I have not seen anything that's so cleanly laid out. So here's my question. There's this myth about love, right? Like, love will conquer all. If you love each other enough, you just get through it. What do you say to this idea of, like, just love each other and it'll work out? When, right, there's things that are on a value level, perhaps, or people are fighting a lot, or, you know, they have trouble in their relationship, but they stick to this idea, but we love each other, so we're going to make it work.
What I say is what you just said, which is that that's a myth, right? That love is not always enough. And I was married previously, before Hannah and I got together, to a wonderful woman, great friend, kind of would love to have had her as my sister, but we were together romantically and it wasn't a perfect fit. It wasn't a great fit. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that I loved her and that she loved me, but it didn't translate into a day-to-day dance that was nourishing and enjoyable. And in the course, what we do is we break this down and we talk about four areas. We talk about chemistry, physical attraction. We talk about styles, how each person moves through the world. We talk about values, our deeply held beliefs, which is at a more profound level than styles. And then we talk about dreams. And what we're suggesting is that we need to have a relatively high degree of compatibility, not the same, it's compatibility around our values, our styles, and our dreams. And it really helps if we have strong chemistry. Strong chemistry is great, but in and of itself, it's not enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard people say love is an action, right? Like, when you're loving someone, you need to be in the action of love. How do you describe love?
Well, I don't know that I've answered that question before, but what I would say is that when I look at another person, when I look at Hannah, what I'm doing is I'm reflecting her beauty and her health, which is how I see her. And when I say beautiful, I don't mean just physically, although she's physically beautiful, but I mean as a person, I see her as a beautiful person and as a very healthy person. And that's what I reflect back. And to me, that's a pretty good description of loving someone.
I love that. That's very beautiful. And last thing on this topic, but the other one that I just would love to hear you talk about, and, you know, again, I just heard it said so often, is this concept of healing, right? So you have a bad dynamic, people have been in a relationship where they're just having, I mean, you could literally put play, right? They've had the same argument so many times, you know, one person's going to say this, the other one's going to say that, and you could pretty much predict how it's going to all play out, but that there's a dynamic and through there, you're going to heal. And so it's worth staying together because this is really an opportunity for spiritual growth or healing. And I think people stay for a really long time and they don't heal. What are your thoughts about when it's healing and when to go? And is love really about healing wounds?
Well, I think that it can be, but I have a fairly different take, which is that it isn't difficult. I think as soon as relating becomes difficult, it is not likely to lead to healing. I think the healing occurs much more profoundly when we're in a relationship that feels easy, where we feel safe, and we feel fundamentally accepted. I think in that scenario, what happens is I start to open my heart, I let my defenses down, and the work, if you will, quote unquote, the work that I do is truly healing. If I'm in a state of constriction, defensiveness, busily projecting onto the other person, even if I'm working, I don't know that I'm going to be doing a lot of healing. I think I may actually end up doing more hurting than healing. And I think related to this, very important for us to recognize that there are certain things that we bring forward from our childhood. We may have some incomplete business from early in our lives. We then transfer that to our romantic partner, trying to work it out with them. I think it's fundamentally inappropriate and unrealistic to think we're going to do that work with our partners. Because, you see, I'm no longer a child and you're no longer, say, my mother. Mm-hmm. The dynamic I had with her is one that to whatever degree I need to work it out, I should have worked it out with her or should still be working it out with her. But to try and work that out with my romantic partner is very confusing. And then the final piece I'll say about this is not everything can be worked out. I may have wounds from when I was 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. And the things that I needed then from my parent or my primary caregiver, the need that I had then, I cannot fulfill today. I cannot necessarily fulfill it today, which means that I need to learn to live with that hole in my heart.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop being bitter about it. Stop blaming you for the fact that I have the experience I do today as an adult, you, my partner, and take responsibility that this is part of me. This goes back to what you and I talked about earlier, Laura. It's part of my authentic self. I have a hole in my heart.
Yes. And you wrote, I'm just going to quote you here. You don't need to be fixed. You're not broken. You simply have a hole in your heart from a parent or caregiver who didn't know how to give you what you needed as a child. But you go on to say, that's okay. Learn to live with that hole and you will be better able to emotionally self-regulate, care for yourself, which is a sign of maturity. So I love this because this idea of like radical responsibility for your own life and not putting that onto somebody else to somehow fix, because it's so hard to put that burden on somebody else. I don't know that they can do it, but what could people do to care for themselves, right? I think people don't know, other than maybe talking to a therapist, what ways can you suggest for somebody who has that hole in their heart for something they didn't have a void that didn't get met by their caregivers? What are some suggestions?
Well, there's so many things here. I'll tick off a few. So the first one that comes to mind is we hear often that we can't love others until we learn to love ourselves. And I don't agree with that at all. So one of the ways that I can heal myself and care for myself is to love others. One of the other ways I can learn to heal and care for myself is to let others love me, even if I'm not good at loving myself. It's one of the ways I learn.
That's so good, Jake. I love that.
And it is possible. It is something that we can do if we give ourselves permission and open up to the possibility. A couple other ideas in terms of caring for self. I believe that a contemplative practice, whether it's meditation or yoga or something of that nature, I think is an extraordinary way to care for and respect ourselves. And so I really encourage people, it doesn't need to be arduous. It could be 10 minutes a day, but it is time that I take, and I think preferably in the morning, so I start my day this way, where I'm doing something that is self-respecting, self-witnessing, self-nurturing. And there are many different forms that can take in terms of a contemplative practice, but I think it's an extraordinary way for us to care for ourselves.
Yes, yes. And I will say, after doing about 100 interviews with people who have lives that are successful, but also that have purpose and they feel authentic in, everybody has some kind of practice. I ask everybody what's their practice, and everybody either, you know, journals or walks in an area of nature or meditates, but they all have something to create space to connect to themselves, to let go of things and just check in with where they really are. So Jake, I ask everybody who comes on the show, and I want to ask you, what does an authentic life then mean to you?
An authentic life to me is about being as present as I can be and honoring what's going on in the moment. And when I say honoring what's going on in the moment, I'm talking about for myself and I'm talking about for other people. To do that, I have to slow down. I have to get a little bit out of my head, because as soon as I go into my head and I start labeling and identifying and telling stories, I'm one step removed from whatever it is that's going on. So I believe that authenticity requires presence, and presence requires slowing down and respectfully witnessing myself and other people.
I love that. That's such a great answer. And what do you do on a daily basis? Do you mention 10 minutes in the morning? Is there anything else you do to stay connected to yourself?
I do four things. We have a 4-minute meditation that I love. It's typically I do it outside, and it's facing each of the four directions, starting with the south and then turning to the east and then the north and the west and back to the south. And it's a highly integrative process, so that in just 4 minutes, I bring myself back to the south and I feel like I've really witnessed and addressed and made space for all the different aspects of myself very efficiently. So I love that. I then have a meditation that I do almost every morning. It's 20 minutes. And I take myself through different levels of consciousness, safety consciousness, then heart consciousness, where I spend time in a state of gratitude and appreciation, and then spacious consciousness, which is where I disconnect from time, and it gives me a much more expanded sense of myself and the possibilities of everything. The third thing I do is I use language in a very specific way. It's the perception language that I mentioned earlier. When I use language in that way, I'm taking responsibility for myself all the time. And by doing that, I calm myself down. I find it's really helpful because I never feel like a victim. Mm-hmm. I never feel like other people are doing things to me.
Yeah.
And that to me is like having a practice that you take off your cushion, because all day long we're talking, whether I'm talking to myself or other people. The way I talk to myself and other people influences the meaning I make. And so if I can make meaning in a more constructive way, a way in which I empower myself, that's a great advantage to go through life that way.
Yeah. Because that voice in your head all day long, if it's in a victim mindset and blaming, right? It's all day long. Yeah. You're feeling disempowered, and it's a tough way to get through the day.
That's right. And the fourth thing I do is another, I think, unique part of our work. It's called a redo. And a redo is essentially acknowledging that I will make mistakes, that I will occasionally behave in a way that I don't feel great about. And when I do that, when I speak to you in a way that I wish I had spoken to you differently, maybe I was impatient or I was intolerant or disrespectful. And this is not the kind of intolerance you and I spoke about earlier. This is me being judgmental or harsh. Let's say I speak to you in that way and I don't feel good about it. So that happens. And let's say that happens at 10 a.m. Well, every minute from 10 a.m. that goes forward, I am suffering because I'm feeling guilty, self-critical, disconnected from you. And the longer I go, the more I suffer. And so a redo is where I come back to you and I do what I wish I had done in the first place. I say myself in the way I wish I had the first time, but for whatever reason, I didn't. And I will literally say to you, Laura, I want to redo something I said to you earlier. I don't apologize. I don't explain. I don't rationalize why I was impatient. I simply speak to you the way I wish I had in the first place. And the sooner I can do the redo, the shorter the time between the behavior I'm unhappy about, my behavior that I'm unhappy about, and the amount of time before I redo myself, the shorter that is, the less I suffer.
Right. Because we think about it in terms of, oh my God, I owe that person an apology, if I'm hearing you correctly. But the truth is, we also suffer because we're feeling guilty. We feel bad. We like maybe, right? It affects our self-worth or whatever it is.
Right. Exactly. I'm living with some judgment, critical judgment about myself and my conduct. And instead, I can just go and redo myself. I mean, if I'm really not happy with the way I spoke to you, why don't I go back and say what I wish I had said the first time?
Yeah. Yeah. Most people, you know, they're avoiding the conflict, right? That's why they don't.
Right. And then they live with that tension and the anxiety about the eventual attempt to clarify and fix whatever went wrong. The other thing is when I do a redo, I've never, ever had anybody not receive it well because I'm taking responsibility. Right. I'm coming to you and I'm saying, you know, I don't feel good about the way I spoke to you earlier. People are really receptive to that and very appreciative.
Yeah, right. They're probably shocked. Like most people don't bother. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, Jake, so much great information. Guys, if you're interested in taking your views of relationships up a notch, I really think this is a great, it's not just this course, there's several others, there's retreats and blogs. If people are interested in finding out more about you, where can they find you?
So our website is called liveconscious.com. Sometimes people think that's live consciously, but it's not. It's liveconscious.com. We've got about 300 articles on there. Some of them are downloadable. There's a couple free ebooks. My book, which was recently released called Get Weird, is on there. And yeah, we do retreats usually a couple a year. We limit them to just about 20 people. And I think the next one we have is in January or February.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you sharing your views with our audience today.
My pleasure. I appreciate your thoughtfulness and the way that you explore things. So thank you.